page 452, The Sociology of Knowledge and Its Consciousness by Theodore W. Adorno. Robert Merton, C. Wright Mills, and others repeatedly complained that the sociology of knowledge failed to solve its central problem of specifying the nexus between social and cognitive structures. Nonetheless, this field has remained limited to techniques of content analysis and correlation studies while failing to explain these categories and correlations other than by recourse to functionalists' truism. For this reason, it is important to point to some of the fundamental reasons for this failure, not imperfect research techniques, but the approach itself fails to examine its own categories as problematic. For example, divisions into popular and classical music, into high and mass culture. These should be the problem rather than the premise on which to classify responses, as Adorno used to complain when he conducted part of the Princeton Radio Research Project with Lazarsfeld. Of necessity, therefore, Mannheim, commonly taken to be the founder of the sociology of knowledge, had to arrive at a leveling pluralism where all ideological positions, all forms of consciousness were alike in that they were the natural correlative of social positions. If he had considered what concretely mediated between social being and consciousness, he might have found a different nexus in every case, depending on what social necessities or possibilities were at work. But such a perspective would have required a theory of the emergence of the social constellations, which Mannheim, in Adorno's eyes, accepts as given. Just as he does, Kohl made sense. Adorno, Horkheimer argued that despite this considerable acumen, Mannheim's accepting and conservative stance leads him to assume abstract principles to be the active agents of history rather than people. Finally, if every ideological position was contingent on a social position, why should the sociology of knowledge be exempt from this postulate? Page 453. The sociology of knowledge, expounded by Karl Mannheim, has begun to take hold in Germany again. For this, it can thank its gesture of innocuous skepticism. Like its existentialist counterparts, it calls everything into question and criticizes nothing. Intellectuals who feel repelled by dogma, real or presumed, find relief in a climate which seems free of bias and assumptions, and which offers them, in addition, something of the pathos of Max Weber's self-conscious and lonely yet undoubted rationality as compensation for their faltering consciousness of their own autonomy. In Mannheim, as in his popular opposite, Jasper, may impulse of Weber's school, which were only deeply embedded in the polyhistoric edifice, come to light. Most important of these is the tendency to suppress the theory of ideologies in its authentic form. These considerations may justify returning to one of Mannheim's older books, Man and Society in an Age of Reconstruction. The work addresses itself to a broader public than does the book on ideology. It cannot be held to each of its own formulations. All the greater, however, is the insight it offers in the influence of the sociology of knowledge. The mentality of the book is positivistic. Social phenomena are taken as such and then classified according to general concepts. In the process, social antagonism invariably tend to be glossed over. They survive merely a subtle modification of a conceptual apparatus, whose distilled principles install themselves autocratically and engage in shadow battles. The ultimate root of all conflicts in a present age of reconstruction can be seized in a single formula. All down the line, tensions arise from the uncontrolled interaction of the laissez-faire principle and the new principle of regulation, as if everything did not depend on who regulates whom, or instead of specific groups of people or a specific structure of society. The irrational is made responsible for the difficulties of the age. The growth of antagonism is elegantly described as the disproportionate development of human capacities, as though it were a question of personalities and not of the anonymous machinery which does away with the individual. Page 454. Right and wrong are glossed over in like manner, like the average man is abstracted from them and assigned an ontological narrow-mindedness which has always been there. Of his experimental self-observation, the term is borrowed from more exact sciences. Mannheim frankly confesses, all these forms of self-observation have the tendency to gloss over and neglect individual differences, because they are interested in what is general in man and its variability, not, however, in its particular situation and in real transformations he undergoes. In its neutrality, the generalizing order of Mannheim's conceptual world is kindly disposed to the real world. It employs the terminology of social criticism while removing its sting. The concept of society as such is rendered impotent from the outset by a language which invokes the exceedingly compromised term integration. Its occurrence is no accident. Mannheim's use of the concept of the social totality serves not so much to emphasize the intricate dependence of man within the totality as to glorify the social process itself as an evening out of the contradictions in the whole. In this balance, theoretically, the contradictions disappear. Also, it is precisely they which compromise the life process of society. Thus, it is not immediately evident that an opinion which prevails in society is the result of a process of selection which integrates many similarly directed expressions of life. What disappears in this notion of selection is the fact that what keeps the mechanism creaking along the human deprivation under conditions of insane sacrifice and the continual threat of catastrophe. The precarious and irrational self-preservation of society is falsified and turned into an achievement of its imminent justice or rationality. While there is integration, elites are never far away. The cultural crises to which in Mannheim terror and horror are readily sublimated becomes for him the problem of the formation of elites. He distills four processes in which this problem is supposed to crystallize: the growing number of elites and the resulting enfeeblement of their influence, the destruction of the exclusiveness of elite groups, the change in the process of selection of elites, and the change in their composition. In the first place, the categories employed in this analysis are highly questionable. The positivists who register the facts, sine ira et studio, is ready to accept the phrase which conceals the facts. One such phrase is the concept of the elite itself. Its untruthfulness consists in the fact that the privilege of a particular group are presented teleologically as the result of some kind of objective process of selection, whereas, in fact, no one has selected these elites but themselves. Page 455. In this use of the concept of the elite, Mannheim overlooks social power. He uses the notion descriptively in the manner of formal sociology. This allows him to shed only as much light as he wishes on each particular privileged group. At the same time, however, the concept of the elite is employed in such a way that the present emergency can be deduced and from above from some equally neutral malfunctioning of the elite mechanism without regard to the state of political economy. In the process, Mannheim comes into open conflict with the facts. When he asserts that in mass democratic societies, it has become increasingly easy for anyone to gain entrance into any sphere of social influence and that the elites are thereby deprived of their exclusive character, which is necessary for the development of intellectual and psychological impulses, he is contradicted by the most humble pre-scientific experience. The deficient homogeneity of the elites is a fiction. One relates to those of chaos in the world of values and the disintegration of all stable forms of order. Whoever does not fit in it, kept out. Even the differences of conviction, which reflects those of real interests, serve primarily to obscure the underlying unity which prevails in all decisive matters. Nothing contributes more to this obfuscation than talk of the cultural crises, to which Mannheim unhesitatingly adds his voice. It transforms real suffering into spiritual guilt, denounces civilization, and generally works to the advantage of barbarism. Cultural criticism has changed its function. The cultural Philistine, who long ceased to be the man of progress, the figure with which Nietzsche identified David Friedrich Strauss. Instead, he has learned profundity and pessimism. In their name, he denies the humanity which has become incompatible with his present interests, and his venerable impulse to destruction turns against the products of the culture, whose decline he sentimentally bemoans. To the sociologist of the cultural crises, this matters little. His heroic ratio does not even refrain from turning the trite thesis of the demise of the formative power of European art since the end of the Biedermeier period against modern art in a manner which is both romantic and reactionary. Accepted along the elite theory is its specific coloration. Conventional notions are joined by naive respects for that which they represent. Mannheim designates blood, property, and achievement as the selection principle of the elites. His passion for destroying ideologies does not lead him to consider even once the legitimacy of these principles. He is actually able during Hitler's lifetime to speak of a genuine blood principle, which is supposed to have formally guaranteed the purity of aristocratic minority stocks and their traditions. From this to the new aristocracy of blood and soil, it is only a step. Page 456. As far as he is concerned, there is still too little blood. He dreads a mass democracy in which blood and property would disappear as principles of selection. The all too rapid changes of elites would threaten continuity. He is particularly concerned with the fact that things are no longer quite right with the esoteric doctrine of the genuine blood principle. It has become democratic and quite suddenly offers to the great masses of the population the privilege of social ascendancy without any achievement. Thus, as the nobility of the past was never any more noble than anyone else, the aristocracy of today has neither an objective nor a subjective interest in really relinquishing the principle of privilege. Elite theory, happy in the environment, unites different levels of what sociologists today call social differentiation, such as feudalism and capitalism under the heading blood and property principle, with equally good humor. It separates what belongs together, property and achievement. Max Weber had shown that the spirit of early capitalism identifies the two, that in a rationally constituted work process, the capacity for achievement can be measured in terms of material success. The equation of achievement and material success found its psychological manifestation in a readiness to make success as such a fetish. In Mannheim, this tendency appears in sublimated form as a state of strife. In bourgeois ideology, property and achievement were first separated when it became obvious that achievement as the economic ratio of the individual no longer corresponds to property as its potential reward. Only then did the bourgeois truly become genteel home. Thus, Mannheim's mechanism of selection are inventions arbitrarily chosen coordinates, distances from the life process of actual society.